Blog Talk Radio.
Skyrocketing healthcare and insurance costs. Extremely modest gains against chronic disease. Thousands die yearly due to drug reactions. What can be done? Thomas Edison is quoted as declaring, "The doctor of the future will give no medicine, but interest his patients in diet and nutrition, exercise, in the care of the human frame. He will teach them about the cause of all disease." The doctors of the future are here. Welcome to Phase 3 Wellness with your host, Keith Henry, ND, one of the doctors of the future.
Hi, and welcome to Phase 3 Wellness. Thank you for joining me this afternoon. I'm your host, Dr. Keith Henry. I'm broadcasting from the Orlando, Florida area. And thank you for joining me wherever you may be joining me from in the world, either here in the United States or wherever you may be. A special welcome to my friends over in Costa Rica. Thank you for listening. We have a very exciting and informative show for you today. The main topic is cabbage, a powerful natural medicine. That's the headline. We're also going to talk a little bit about thyme and how, when compared to ibuprofen, especially for menstrual cramp pain, it outperforms ibuprofen pretty significantly. So again, I'd like to remind you to join me every week here at the same time from 7 to 8 p.m. Again, we've been testing this time out for a while. We used to come on from 4 to 5. We've been testing this prime time slot out for a while, and we're going to continue to test to see how it works out. Again, I'd like to remind you, you can listen if you have not listened to any of our programs in the past. If you've missed any, you can just come to blogtalkradio.com/phase3wellness, and you can listen to episodes on demand whenever you like. You can download them to CD, listen to them in your car, and et cetera. Now, also remind you, you can shoot me, if you like, you can shoot me a friend request on Facebook. Just go to facebook.com/naturedoc, and as you listen to the show, you will hear other ads, commercials we run, pointing you to our website for a lot of information, etc. Again, I'd like to welcome you again. I'd like to remind you, we also have the chat room up here. If you'd like to ask a question, I know sometimes people don't like to come on air and ask questions live. They would prefer asking questions through the chat. So we also have that up if you just go to blogtalkradio.com/faith-wellness. I'd like to also remind you that we're going to follow as normal our normal outline. We're in the first segment. It's the Week in Natural Health Review, Week in Review, rather, and the Week in Natural News Review, where we talk about some of the articles that have come out with respect to natural healing and natural news. The second segment, we typically deal with a healing food or a group of healing food. And the third segment, we typically deal with a healing supplement or a healing herb. And so what we're going to do, we have quite a bit of information to cover. I'm going to take a quick break. We're going to come back, and we are going to get started. Stay tuned, for we have a very, very insightful show for you. Back in just a second.
How do you feel? No, really. How do you feel? Do you feel lively? Are you bursting with energy? Or do you feel run down and suffer from a lack of energy most of the time? Have frequent colds, aches, and pains of one sort or another? The fact of the matter is that most people in America are not well. But you can begin to change all of that today by simply visiting the Simple Natural Health Secrets blog of Keith Henry, ND, at www.phase3ministries.com/wordpress. Go there now and explore the wealth of amazing wellness information. That's www.phase3ministries.com/wordpress. The Simple Natural Health Secrets Blog.
You're listening to Phase 3 Wellness with Dr. Keith Henry. Be sure to listen right here every week at the same time. You can also visit Dr. Henry on Facebook at facebook.com/naturedoc. Thanks for listening, and here's to your health.
Hi, and welcome back to Phase 3 Wellness. I am your host, Dr. Keith Henry. Thank you for joining me. We're going to go ahead and get started And we're going to start off in our week in natural news review. Again, this is where we talk about articles that have come out during the week. And our first article is going to be an article that's taken from naturalnews.com. That's naturalnews.com. And it was entitled, How to Recognize a Magnesium Deficiency. Now, in the past shows, we've gone through many of the nutrient deficiency signs. We've looked at vitamin B vitamins, we've looked at vitamin C, vitamin D, many of them. But this is another article that come out, and seeing as how we deal with these new articles as they come out, a lot of people forget what we've talked about, forget what we discussed, so it's good to just bring these things back again and discuss them and rediscuss them, and even sometimes new information comes out. And so what we're going to look at here is, and this article came out this week and from naturalnews.com, and again, it's entitled, it was published on May 21st, Wednesday, and it's entitled, Warning Signs You Are Deficient in Magnesium. Now, magnesium is one of your most important minerals. And all of your minerals are important, but it's one of the ones that is extremely important. And you will know very, very, very intently once you have become chronically deficient in a mineral such as magnesium. Now, in this particular article, the author starts off, Ruben Chow is his name, pointing out how magnesium is a very important mineral. And in fact, as I've told you before on here, it's the second most abundant mineral that is contained within your human cells. In fact, some 60% of it in the human body is contained within the bone. So some 60% of the magnesium in the body is actually contained within your bones, another more than 25% in the muscles, and the rest in soft tissue and body fluids. And so some of the functions of magnesium. Magnesium plays a role in activating many of the enzymes that are in your body. It also plays a role in maintaining the electrical charges of cells, especially in your nerves as well as in your muscles, in terms of muscle contraction and muscle relaxation. Not only that, magnesium is also involved in many of your cellular functions, such as your energy production, your cellular replication, your lipid synthesis, as well as your protein formation. In fact, it even contributes to bone formation. It also helps you regulate your calcium metabolism. So, yeah, as you can see, magnesium is crucially important mineral. Now, magnesium plays a critical role also in your heart health. And think about it for a second. I said earlier that, as the author points out in this article, that over 25% of the magnesium contained in your body is in your muscles, and your heart is actually a muscle. So it would make sense that, as the author points out, that magnesium actually plays a critical role in your heart health, contributing to your energy production as well as your heart muscle contraction. So by raising the solubility of calcium in your urine, magnesium actually helps prevent the formation of kidney stones. So indeed, magnesium supplementation has been found to help with preventing kidney stone recurrence in those who have a tendency to develop kidney stone formation. And again, if you've ever had kidney stones, if you've known someone who has kidney stones are not something that you want to have any type of an experience with. And so just remember, magnesium is extremely important. Now, Chow, in this particular article, again, taken from naturalnews.com, he goes on to point out some of the deficiency symptoms of magnesium. And here's some of the warning signs that you could be lacking magnesium, some of which are similar to those of potassium deficiency. Now, again, potassium is also a very, very, very important mineral. But some of the deficiencies in magnesium are in harmony or consistent with some of the same deficiencies you see when you have a deficiency of potassium. Again, if you have any of these symptoms, get yourself tested, get a blood test, a lava test, etc., to make sure that you are not deficient in these areas. As you heard me say before, if you get a blood test and you find that you are not deficient in magnesium, or the blood test shows that you may be in normal range, but on the low range, do a saliva test over the course of a week. I'm not a saliva test. I mean, I'm sorry. An acid alkaline test over the course of a week to make sure and to determine that your acid levels are not high, or that your body is not headed toward acidosis, or the levels of the body in the acid are higher than the levels of alkalinity in the body. Even if you're not seeing a deficiency in your blood test, if you see that in your pH test, your acid alkaline test, if you're heading that way, you can know that you're going to have problems, even though it may not be showing up yet in the blood. So again, some of the deficiency signs are heart disturbances, issues with nerve conduction and muscle contraction, muscle cramps and muscle spasms, poor coordination, weakness, chronic fatigue, headaches, including migraines as well as tension headaches, appetite loss, insomnia, craving for sweet, mental confusion, irritability, personality changes, and being easily stressed. People with low levels of magnesium, he points out in this article, are more prone to ailments such as insomnia, premenstrual syndrome, menstrual cramps, hair loss, swollen gums, high blood pressure, kidney stones, heart disease, and even cancer. In fact, he says it has been found that persons who suffered sudden and fatal heart attacks had very low magnesium levels in their hearts. So when magnesium levels are low, a spasm of the coronary arteries that could actually take place, affecting the flow of blood and oxygen to your heart, this could trigger a heart attack and even death. The article goes on to point out further, persons with fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome are also commonly found to have low magnesium levels. So again, you hear about fibromyalgia, you hear about chronic fatigue syndrome, and people are always tired, etc. Just remember, as I've talked about on here before, it's very, very, it's crucial to understand how typically all diseases have their origin in certain biochemical, or us being deficient in certain minerals, vitamins, other nutrients, enzymes, etc. And long-term chronic deficiencies of these minerals or vitamins, etc., this broad spectrum of nutrients will eventually cause some disease or abnormalities to develop. So it's very, very important to understand the importance of eating correctly, following those laws of health that I talk about on here all the time. Again, trust in the Creator, sunshine, exercise, water, air, rest, diet, and self-control or / temperance. Again, other deficiency causes, or we're talking about some of the deficiency causes, and we've already talked about some of the deficiencies, typically due to poor food choices with diets lacking in natural whole foods. As I just pointed out, many people do not actually consume enough magnesium. And in this particular article that we're analyzing here from naturalnews.com, Child also says elderly persons, especially those with health issues, are more susceptible to magnesium deficiency. He says women are also more likely to be deficient during their premenstrual period. Factors which elevate the secretion or reduces its absorption could also lead to magnesium deficiency. And these include, he says, intake of too much calcium. Again, magnesium and calcium must be balanced. This is when you get into the importance of balancing your minerals and nutrients, etc. Second, he points out alcohol consumption. He said it has been found that as much as 60% of alcoholics have low levels of magnesium. As alcohol increases, the amount of magnesium excreted in the urine, or rather, alcohol increases rather the amount of magnesium which is excreted in the urine. And this deficiency, he points out, could be a big reason why alcoholics are more likely to suffer from cardiovascular disease, liver disease, kidney disease, diabetes, digestive disorders like malabsorption, use of oral contraceptives, diuretics, and/or medications which deplete magnesium levels, and surgery are all things that can contribute to you creating a magnesium deficiency in your body. Let me point out those again. If you drink alcohol, if your intake of calcium is too high in ratio to the magnesium intake, liver disease, kidney disease, diabetes, digestive disorders like malabsorption, the use of oral contraceptives, diuretics, and or medications which deplete magnesium levels, and surgery. All of these things can cause your magnesium levels to drop and cause other problems. The author says it should be noted that standard blood tests do not flag up magnesium deficiency until it's already severe, often after the onset of a serious health condition. Thus, the symptoms and dietary choices would offer some clues. The best food sources of magnesium, he points out, include kelp, dulse, molasses, buckwheat, wheat bran, wheat germ, millet, rye, tofu, and nuts, including almonds, cashews, Brazil nuts, peanuts, pecans, and English walnuts. So again, excellent article by Reuben Child. It's taken from naturalnews.com. And this is what I said earlier. He points out, as I pointed out as well, that oftentimes by the time a magnesium deficiency will show up on a blood test, it's already too late. And so this is why I've always advocated doing a testing with the pH test. I advocate doing it with saliva. And again, let me repeat the best way to do it, because just by doing it once, you're not going to get an accurate reading. So I recommend going, typically you go into your local health food store or your natural health practitioner if you have one. You can go in and order off Amazon some high quality pH sticks. And you can use saliva or you can use your urine. I would recommend using your saliva. You get a little bit more accurate reading there. And you take your pH saliva 3 times a day. A little while before you eat. Don't take it soon. Don't take it within 3 hours after eating a meal. You're not going to get an accurate reading. So just make sure you take it before you eat, or at least 3 hours after you eat. Take it in the morning, take it in the afternoon, and then take it again in the evening. And write down each reading, and then add all of those readings together and take the average and write that down for the first day. You do that same thing every day for 7 days. So you get the reading, say, for Sunday. And after adding all three of those readings together, you get that reading, that average. You do the same thing Monday. You get the average of the three on Monday. You get the average of the three on Tuesday, so forth and so on. After 7 days, you add all of those averages together. And then the average that you get from those 7 days will give you a very accurate portrayal of what your pH balance is in your body. And if you see that is leaning toward being acid, or that it is acid, even if your blood test shows that you're okay, you're going to begin to have subclinical issues, even though you might not have symptoms as of yet. So that's one of the best ways, you know, to keep your body in a little bit more alkaline than acid, because once it gets in that acid state, and if it stays there, and your blood and your urine, as well as saliva, your bodily fluids, they're going to be a little bit more acid soon after you eat, which is natural. But your average pH balance should be in it should be more alkaline than acid. And if it's not, you're going to eventually develop problems. And again, your blood tests and whatnot, people often say, "Oh yeah," then when they come up sick, they say, "No, I had a blood test just 6 months ago, and now I have cancer," or whatever it is. Again, tests, please realize this, that tests have their role. They're very important. But they just help an experienced practitioner they're just a tool, taking also into account a conversation assessment with the patient or client, also take into account the several blood tests. So everything is like a piece of a puzzle. And when you take the blood test, saliva test, this test, that test, questioning, just an overall assessment of the person, the lifestyle, the symptoms, everything makes the big picture. And you bring all those pieces of the puzzle together. Then once you bring all those pieces of the puzzle together, then and only then can you see the big picture. But just having a blood test here and this test here and basing an entire treatment protocol or diagnosis on these things is very unwise. You're listening to Phase 3 Wellness. I'm your host, Dr. Keith Henry. We're still in our first segment, the Week in Natural News Review segment. And our next article is going to be taken from Mercola.com. And Dr. Mercola, again, is a very interesting article. And I'm going to see. First, let me put, for those of you who may be on the, have the chat open, let me put a link to the article that we just finished taking a look at in the box in the event you would like to go over there and check out the article on your own and read it in its detail. And now we'll move on to our next article in this segment, and that article is going to be an article from Dr. Mercola. And we're only going to deal with two articles in this first segment before we move on. And this article, again, is from Mercola.com, and it came out on the a little bit earlier than, it's like a day later than our Week in Natural News Review deadline. But it falls in just one day off, so we're going to take a look at it. And it's entitled, How Your Microbiome Controls Your Health. Now, I know I don't want to get too technical here, but we're going to go into this, and I won't get too technical. But basically, you'll see where I'm going with this. It's very important. And Dr. Mercola starts out by talking about the interconnectedness of your gut, your brain, your immune, and your hormonal symptoms. And you heard me say that before. All natural practitioners understand that all of the body works as a unit. The mental, the physical, the spiritual, the emotional, they all work together. You could be having problems somewhere in your body, and the origin could be in your mind, or the origin could be anywhere. It could be anywhere, and it can be affecting any other system or organ. So you have to take the body as a whole. Therefore, you have the idea of holistic medicine. Now, Dr. Mercola talks about the interconnectedness in this article of your gut, your brain. He says your hormonal and your immune system, etc. And he goes on to point out how it's impossible to unwind these things. He says the past few years has brought a scientific flurry of information about how crucial your microflora is to your genetic expression, your immune system, your body weight and composition, your mental health, your memory, and minimizing your risk for numerous diseases from diabetes even to cancer. And then he points out a researcher by the name of Jerome Reyes, featured on the TED Talk, discovered that you might even belong to one of a few microflora types, which are similar to blood types. He says research in the human microbiome is in fact in its infancy, and there is much we do not yet understand, he says. He goes on to say, that said, there are some facts of which we are already certain. He said, it is becoming increasingly clear that destroying your gut flora with pharmaceutical drugs, harsh environmental chemicals, and toxic foods is a primary factor in rising disease rates. He goes on to say further, recent research suggests intestinal inflammation may play a critical role in the development of certain cancers. He says until we begin to appreciate this complex relationship, we will not be able to prevent or intervene effectively in many of the diseases that are devastating people's lives today. In order for true healing and meaningful prevention to occur, he says, you must continuously send your body messages that it is safe, not under attack, and that it is well nourished, supported, and calm. And then it goes into this article. Now, this microbiome subject that we're going to discuss is very important as I go into it in this particular article. Now, he asks the question, how can you feel lonely with 100 trillion constant companions? He says, the idea that microorganisms are to be divided and conquered is now an outdated view of our world. He says, we not only live with them and are surrounded by them, but we depend on them for our very existence. And then he points out Pamela Wintraub, who skillfully described the symbiosis between humans and microorganisms in her June 2013 article in Experience Life magazine. And she points out in this article, and he quotes her, how your body is a complex ecosystem made up of more than 100 trillion microbes that actually must be properly balanced and cared for if you are to be healthy. You heard the word homeostasis, which basically means balance. But she's talking about balance in terms of these microbes alone, notwithstanding the other parts of the body. She goes on to point out that this system of bacteria, fungi, viruses, and protozoa living on your skin, in your mouth, in your nose, your throat, your lungs, your gut, and your urogenital tract is referred to as the human microbiome. So this is what we're talking about. When you heard me say microbiome, you hear him talking about microbiome, we're talking about the system of bacteria, fungi, viruses, and protozoa that live on your skin and in your mouth, your nose, your throat, your lung, your gut, and your urogenital tract. She goes on to point out in this article from June 2013 in Experience Life magazine that it varies, the system varies from person to person based on factors such as your diet, your health history, your geographic location, and even your ancestry. So she says when your microbiome falls out of balance, you can become ill. Those organisms perform a multitude of functions in key biological systems, from supplying critical vitamins to fighting pathogens, modulating weight, and metabolism. She says this army of organisms also makes up 70% of your immune system, quote, talking directly to your body's natural killer T cells so that they can tell apart your friendliness from dangerous invaders. She says your microbiome also helps control how your genes express themselves. So by optimizing your native flora, you are actually controlling your genes. Now, this is something that us in the natural health field have been talking about for a while, how your actually your mental thoughts, your mental state, the way that you eat, the way that you live, the way that you sleep, all of these things can cause your mind or your brain to send biochemical messages throughout your body, and even to the extent that it can affect your genes. Now, so a lot of times you hear people say, well, you know, I developed this because I have a family history of it, and it was in my mother's genes or my father's genes. Granted, you can be predisposed to develop certain diseases, but what most people don't realize, simply being predisposed to develop a certain disease or abnormality does not automatically guarantee. What happens in most cases is, say you were predisposed to having breast cancer. Say your mother had it, your grandmother had it, et cetera, or prostate cancer, whatever. What typically happens, just because you have a predisposition, you still have to hit the light switch. So it's like going into a room with a light bulb there, with the electricity being on in the house and the light bulb being well enough to come on, not being a dead light bulb. But just because that room has a predisposition for the light to be turned on does not mean that you have to hit the switch and turn it on. It's similar to that in the body. When you go in, you can live in such a way, eat, drink, sleep, live, deal with your stresses in such a way that you never flip the light switch on, even though you may have a predisposition to it. In like manner, you can have a lifestyle that you may already have a predisposition to it, and although you have a predisposition and you can eat and live in such a way that you click the light switch on and you would develop it quicker than someone else who didn't have the disposition, who ate just as bad as you did, but because they didn't have a predisposition, they didn't develop it, or they didn't develop it as soon as you developed it, or they may not have developed it at all. So this is why you will see, when you look at the literature, you will find that in many cases, people develop these diseases who had no family history of them. So a lot of times I find that a lot of people will use that, not always, as an excuse to justify eating badly or not living healthy. And again, you know, just because you have a genetic predisposition to it does not mean that you would automatically discover it, or I'm sorry, develop it. Now, and getting back to this article, as she pointed out, we actually have the capacity, given our mental state, our emotional state, / mental emotional state, our spiritual state, to actually affect the expression in our genes, which is astonishing when you think about it. Now, Dr. McCullough goes on to say in this article, he says, your microbiome is closely intertwined with both of your brains. Now, on here, if you've listened to me before, you've heard me talking about the second brain, or the brain in your gastrointestinal tract. When you look at the way it's configured down there, the way this body is made, the nervous system down there, the network there, is similar to the nervous system and the networks in your brain. And the brain in your gastrointestinal tract actually relays messages up to your brain up top. So it's considered the second brain. It's just that important. So he goes on to say how your microbiome is closely intertwined with both of your brains. Yes, he says you have two. In addition to the brain in your head, embedded in the wall of your gut is your enteric nervous system, which works both independently of and in conjunction with the brain in your head. And then he quotes New Scientist, where it says the ENS, or the enteric nervous system, is part of the autonomic nervous system, the network of peripheral nerves that control visceral functions. It is also the original nervous system emerging in the first vertebrates. Now, they go into talking about evolution. And as you know, I am a Christian naturopath, so I do not prescribe to that it took billions and billions of years for us to evolve. Again, as I've said on here before, all natural medicine, all people who practice natural medicine will address the body holistically. That means they will also include addressing the spiritual side of it. I choose to address the spiritual side of natural medicine from a Christian worldview and from a Christian perspective. I happen to believe that the Bible, and can demonstrate it fairly well, that the Bible is highly scientific, and it is the most consistent religious document, ancient document that we have with the laws of health, and when you look at the way that the body functions scientifically. And so this is why I believe that it is the best, when you're dealing with the spiritual man, it's the best book to use. Now, to go on, Dr. Mercola goes on to say, your ENS, or your enteric nervous system, is thought to be largely responsible for your gut instincts, responding to environmental threats and sending information to your brain that affects your well-being. He says, I'm sure you've experienced various sensations in your gut that accompany strong emotions such as fear, excitement, and stress. He says, like feeling butterflies in your stomach is actually the result of blood being diverted away from your gut to your muscles as part of the flight or fight response. He goes on to say that these gut reactions happen outside of your conscious awareness because they are part of your autonomic nervous system, just like the beating of your heart. Your ENS contains 500 million neurons. He says, why so many? Because eating is fraught with danger. And then he goes on to say, like the skin, the gut must stop potentially dangerous invaders, such as bacteria and viruses, from getting inside the body. If a pathogen should cross the gut lining, immune cells in the gut wall secrete inflammatory substances, including histamine, which are detected by neurons in the ENS, or the enteric nervous system. The gut brain then either triggers diarrhea or alerts the brain in the head, which may decide to initiate vomiting, or both may occur. He says, we know that this communication between your two brains runs both ways and is the pathway for how foods affect your mood. For example, he says, fatty foods make you feel good because fatty acids are detected by cell receptors in the lining of your gut, which then send warm and fuzzy nerve signals to your brain. Knowing this, he says, you can begin to understand how not only your physical health, but also your mental health is deeply influenced by the health of your gut and the microbial zoo that lives there. He says, your gut microbes affect your overall brain function, from basic mood swings to the development of serious illnesses like autism, Alzheimer's disease, and schizophrenia. Now, this is one of the things that a lot of people don't understand, is, and sometimes when I do seminars, I talk about this. What you eat, what you put in your mouth, affects your brain. It affects your worldview. It affects your intellect. It affects your spirituality. And many people have depression, and have, because they've eaten themselves into depression, because of what I just explained. Not only that, they've not followed those other laws of health that I've mentioned before. So think about it. We know from science that you can affect your mental mood by what you eat because of the second brain that's contained in your gastrointestinal tract, or the neuric system, enteric nervous system. Dr. Mercola goes on to point out further in this article. He says, your gut is the starting point for inflammation. It's actually the gatekeeper of your inflammatory response. He says, according to psychoneuroimmunologist Kelly Brogan, your gut's microorganisms trigger the production of cytokines. Cytokines are involved in regulating your immune system response to inflammation and infection. Much like hormones, cytokines are signaling molecules that aid cell-to-cell communication, telling your cells where to go when your inflammatory response is initiated. He says, most of the signals between your gut and your brain travel along your vagus nerve. You've heard me talk about the vagus nerve on here before as well. It says about 90% of the signals between your gut and your brain actually travel along this nerve. And your vagus is Latin for wandering. And this is aptly named, he says, as this long nerve travels from your skull down through your chest and abdomen, branching to multiple organs. Cytokine messages, he points out, further produced in your gut, cruise up to your brain along the vagus nerve highway. Once in your brain, the cytokines tell your microalgae, which are the immune cells in your brain, to perform certain functions, such as producing neurochemicals. Some of these have negative effects on your mitochondria. Now, the mitochondria is the center part of your cell. The mitochondria is contained in the nucleus of your cell. This is where the energy of the cell is produced. It's like the powerhouse of the cell. And so he says some of these have negative effects on your mitochondria, which can impact energy production and cell death, as well as adversely impacting the very sensitive feedback system that controls your stress hormones, including cortisol. So this inflammatory response that started in your gut travels to your brain, which then builds on it and sends signals to the rest of your body in a complex feedback loop. So it isn't important that you understand all of the physiology here, but the takeaway, he says, is that your gut flora's influence is far from local. It significantly affects and controls the health of your entire body. So basically, how we eat can affect the flora in our guts, our gut flora, the bacteria. And if you have more good bacteria there, you're going to be better off. If you have more bad bacteria there, you're going to have problems. So to keep that balance, the balance is to keep more good bacteria than bad bacteria there. Now, I'm going to put the rest of the article in the chat if you're there. But before I put the rest of it, I just want to cover one last part of the article because we need to move on. It says your gut bacteria and therefore your physical and mental health continuously affected by your environment, he says, and by your diet, lifestyle, and your diet and lifestyle choices. He says if your microbiome is hammed and thrown out of balance, all sorts of illnesses can result, both acute and chronic. He says, unfortunately, your fragile internal ecosystem is under nearly constant assault today, and some of the factors posing the gravest dangers to your microbiome are outlined, he says, below. Refined sugar, especially processed high fructose corn syrup, conventionally raised meats and other animal products, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs called NSAIDs. These damage your cell membranes and disrupt energy production by mitochondria. That's basically the pain meds like Advil and Tylenol and some of these other ones. Chlorinated and or fluoridated water, genetically engineered foods, extremely abundant in processed foods and beverages, gluten for many people, proton pump inhibitors, drugs that block the production of acid in your stomach, typically prescribed for GERD, such as Prilosec and Nexium. You've seen the commercials about these antibiotics. Use them only, he points out, if absolutely necessary, and make sure to receive your gut with fermented foods and a good probiotic supplement. I would always recommend a good probiotic supplementation. Again, if you can, it's always best to try to use natural antibiotics first. If you don't know how to use them effectively, get with a natural practitioner or a medical doctor who's well versed in natural medicine. Because in most cases, 99% of cases, if you have an infection, if you know how to effectively use natural remedies, you can knock that infection out, as opposed to having to go and use antibiotics. And remember, if you have a viral infection, antibiotics can't help you anyway. So again, that's another issue. I'm going to put the link to this article, the rest of the article. I covered the good majority of it, but I'm going to put the link of it for those of you who may be on the in the chat room. If you want to go and check the article out yourself, you can do so. And now we're going to move on to our next section, which is our healing food section, and we're going to talk about cabbage here and how effective, amazingly effective, cabbage is. We can take a break now, but I'll wait after we cover this, and before we go into our final section, we'll take a quick, maybe 1 minute break, and we'll come back. But right now, we'll go ahead and we'll deal with the cabbage, and we're going to put this in our over here in our healing food segment. This is the segment that we talk about a healing food or healing foods and the benefits thereof of the foods that the Creator has given us. Now, you've heard me say before that if you eat, the closer you eat in harmony with the colors of the rainbow, and the closer you eat to the garden, the healthier you'll be. So if your food is healthy, natural, is closer to the garden or the grove as possible, and it has one of the colors of the rainbow, the healthier you are. That's red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, and violet. Those are the colors of the rainbow. So if your food falls in those colors, it's almost like a color-coded nutrition that the Creator has given us. And today we will talk a little bit about cabbage. Now, cabbage is one of the best and most efficacious foods for health that you can find. It is actually like broccoli and cauliflower. It's in that same family. And if you look at history, the ancient Greeks would routinely prescribe cabbage or cabbage juice to treat constipation or for mushroom poisoning. And while the ancient Egyptians actually consumed cabbage before meals to lower the intoxicating effects of the wine. And the British even brought cabbage to the trenches of World War I because they found that its leaves helped to treat trench foot and bandage ulcers. Now, natural practitioners, we've used it in cases of inflammation, bruises. You can take a cabbage, take a couple of leaves of that cabbage, and you can beat it, you know, like maybe with a wooden spoon, beat it with something to break up the outer skin, and then you can wrap it around a bruise or a strain. Like some people may strain their ankles, or oftentimes the cabbage, and even swelling, I've seen it pull out inflammation and swelling and edema. I've seen cabbage pull it out. Again, cabbage historical uses, as I just pointed out, go back for quite a while. And not only that, its use is actually a testament to how effective it is. And cabbage, like broccoli, shares a similar nutritional profile as to broccoli. And we know, we've talked about on here before, how effective broccoli has been shown in tests and clinical trials to be against cancer. Now, what about cabbage, though? Cabbage, all cabbages, including white cabbage, which are the most commonly eaten cabbages in the U.S., contain high concentrations of disease-fighting, what we call phytonutrients, such as polyphenols and glucosinolates. These are basically plant nutrients. We call them phytonutrients. There was a study published in the Asian Pacific Journal of Cancer Prevention in 2013, just last year, and they found that cabbage heads could actually contribute as sources of important antioxidant as well as anti-inflammatory related to the prevention of chronic diseases associated to oxidative stress, such as in cancer and coronary artery disease. Now, this was a study that was published in the Asian Pacific Journal of Cancer Prevention, basically saying that cabbage can actually help ward off cancer, essentially is what it's saying. Now, of all the cabbages that have been tested by scientists, red cabbages have contained the most antioxidant, while Chinese, Savoy, and green cabbages contain the strongest anti-inflammatory properties. So again, let me say that again. Of all the cabbages tested by scientists, red cabbages contain the most antioxidant, while Chinese, Savoy, and green cabbages contain the strongest anti-inflammatory properties. And these results actually suggest that depending on the type of cabbage we consume, we can maximize our phytochemical intake. Now, this study that I just mentioned before and some other studies have brought out quite a bit of information concerning cabbage. For instance, there was a study published in Evidence-Based Complementary and Alternative Medicine in 2008 of September, and they found that diabetic rats that were fed red cabbage extracts for 60 days exhibited reduced blood glucose levels, restored renal function, and improved weight loss when compared to the control group. And then as a result of this, researchers ascribed these results to the cabbage's antioxidant and anti-hypoglycemic properties, which offer what they put as, quote, a potential therapeutic source for the treatment of diabetes, end quote. In this particular study, in these two studies I just cited, we found that in one case, we've seen that science shows the phytonutrients that's contained in the cabbage. And the second case, we've seen how it's anti-diabetic for those who have high blood sugar. Also, when you look closer at cabbage, we find that it has it's great in sources of vitamin C as well as vitamin K. In fact, a half cup of cooked green cabbage contains approximately 47% of the recommended daily allowance of vitamin C and about 102% of the recommended daily allowance of vitamin K. Now, remember, we've talked about on here before that if you're low in vitamin D and if you live in an area where you don't have a lot of sunshine, or you live in an area where it's in the winter months, you're not getting sunshine, and you're taking supplemental vitamin D, it's crucial to eat a copious amounts of vegetables for the vitamin K content, or supplemental vitamin D could cause problems. So they're finding that, again, a half a cup of cooked green cabbage contains about 47% of the recommended daily allowance of vitamin C and about 102% of the recommended daily allowance of vitamin K. Vitamin C, of course, is an essential antioxidant. We've talked about that on here before. Cabbage is also good for the skin and the hair, and it also helps prevent accelerated aging. Vitamin K also aids blood clotting as well as it maintains bone health. In fact, all leafy green vegetables contain these two vitamins, although some contain more than others. For instance, you have broccoli and Brussels sprouts contain the most vitamin C, while kale and spinach are the undisputed kings of vitamin K. So again, if you want some fresh, high volume, and especially if you can get these things organically, sources of vitamin C and vitamin K, you can have your kale, your broccoli, your Brussels sprouts, your cabbage. You're going to get quite a bit of these nutrients that you need. Now, cabbage also excels in all of the areas expected for foods that are used to lose weight. Cabbage is low in calories and carbohydrates. It contains no fat, is low in the glycemic index, and is high in fiber. So anything that's high in fiber tends to help get things moving along in your colon area as well. Moreover, cabbage is highly versatile, and again, you have some people who like to eat it just as it is. Some people would like to put it in stews and soups, etc. So basically, cabbage is excellent for diabetes. It's excellent food if you need vitamins and nutrients. It's excellent food to help fight off cancer. It's excellent food to help, well, not a food per se, but it's an excellent remedy to wrap for sore joints and bruises, etc. Again, that's cabbage. You're listening to Phase 3 Wellness. I am your host, Dr. Keith Henry. We have about 15 minutes left here, and we have a couple of more subjects in our healing herb. We're going to take about a one-minute break, and we're going to come back and look at a study that compared thyme oil head-to-head with ibuprofen, and we're going to see how and why thyme oil came out on top for pain. Again, we're going to find out why thyme oil came out on top for pain. I'll be back in just a moment.
Skyrocketing health care and insurance costs. Extremely modest gains again.
You're listening to Phase 3 Wellness with Dr. Keith Henry. Be sure to listen right here every week at the same time. You can also visit Dr. Henry on Facebook at facebook.com/naturedoc. Thanks for listening, and here's to your health.
Do you know anyone that has health issues? Of course you do. Have you noticed the rise in popularity of natural therapies and alternative medicine? Sure you have. Have you ever wondered if alternative therapies work or if it's just all quackery? Then you need to visit the Simple Natural Health Secrets blog at phase3ministries.com/WordPress. Keith Henry, ND, is trained in natural naturopathy and provides amazing insight at the Simple Natural Health Secrets blog that he has gained from years of hands-on experience. Check it out after this show at phase3ministries.com/WordPress.
Hi, and welcome back to Phase 3 Wellness. Thank you for listening. I am your host, Dr. Keith Henry. We're down to our last 10 minutes or so of the show, and we are in the final segment, the segment which we call Healing Herb, Healing Supplement segment, where we look at either healing herb or healing supplement, or a number of them that we like and we've seen perform well, or that there's a lot of evidence for. And today we're looking at, basically a study that came out of Iran, Babel University of Medical Science, and they looked at thyme oil. And in this particular study, they looked at how thyme oil beats ibuprofen for relieving menstruation pain. So let's look at this study. Now, these researchers from Iran's Babel University of Medical Science found out or confirmed that thyme is not only an excellent pain-relieving herb, but it also reduces pain of difficult menstruation better than ibuprofen. The researchers in this particular study tested 84 women university students who had reported difficult menstruation. The young women were aged from between the ages of 18 to 24 years old, and all were suffering from primary dysmenorrhea. Now, primary dysmenorrhea is usually defined as painful cramping that may or may not come with other symptoms such as backache, nausea, headaches, and dizziness. And secondary dysmenorrhea usually indicates menses pain that is related to another underlying condition. And they were looking at the ones with primary dysmenorrhea. Now, the researchers added to the definition of primary dysmenorrhea that it appears within 2 years of the beginning of menses and no pelvic pain during the other parts of the monthly cycle, and there's no pelvic pain during other parts of the monthly cycle. And so the researchers divided the students into three groups, and in each group there were 28 of these young ladies. And group one was given 200 milligrams of ibuprofen per dose plus 25 drops of a placebo essential oil. Group two was given 25 drops of 2% essential oil of thyme, and the type they're given was thymus vulgaris, plus a placebo capsule per dose. Group three was given 25 drops of the placebo essential oil plus the placebo capsule. Each subject was instructed to begin the treatment on the first day of their menstruation with a dose every 6 hours. So remember, if you look at this, only one group of the three groups had any of the thyme oil, and it was only 2% of the thyme and citrus oil. The pain intensity was recorded at the beginning before treatment was started, and an hour after each dose, and 24 and 48 hours after they began the treatment. So they also were asked to rate their blood flow, the blood flow of their menstrual cycle, of course. According to the study, the visual analog scale, the VAS, was used to rate their pain intensity. The thyme essential oil group's average pain scores went from 6.57 prior to treatment to 1.21 during the first menstrual cycle tested, and from 1.21 to 1.14 during the second menstrual cycle. Meanwhile, the ibuprofen group's pain scores went from 5.30 to 1.48 in the first cycle and back up to 1.68 during the second menstrual cycle. So it's interesting when you look at the group who had the who was taking the essential oil, their scores started off higher even than and essentially they were having more pain than those who were taking ibuprofen. So that would mean that the thyme oil worked even greater for more intense pain than did the ibuprofen. And if you look at the thyme results indicate that while the thyme oil therapeutic effects continued for the women, not only completely during their first menstrual cycle, but clear through their second menstrual cycle, the ibuprofen's pain-relieving effects were decreased during the second cycle. Now, they began to take them during their first cycle, but they continued during the second cycle. And essentially what happened, based upon the numbers, was although they kept taking both, the thyme worked, and it only did continue to work, but it worked even better. So the pain decreased even more, whereas in the ibuprofen, the pain relieving effects of the ibuprofen begin to get lessen over time. And if you look at the low concentration of thyme oil, only 2%. So, you know, that's a very low concentration of thyme oil. What would have happened if it would have been 5%, for instance? So this decreasing effect often is the case for pharmaceutical or drugs. And it's basically called drug tolerance. And what happens is because these chemicals that break down the body's detoxification immune system, they are seen as foreigners. And so live enzymes from your liver, or liver enzymes rather, would target and break down the chemicals in these drugs, and over time it would develop an increasing inefficiency in the way that these drugs can benefit work in your body. Not only that, the cells may also become more resistant to the chemicals from the drug, as receptors that initially allow the chemical access are modified, causing receptor down-regulation, if you will. So now natural medicinal herbs are typically not seen as foreigners because they have complexity. In other words, if you think about it, when I said earlier before, one of the reasons that I am a Christian naturopath and I address natural medicine from a Christian perspective, to me it makes perfect sense that if we were taken, which is the testimony, the story of the Bible, if man was actually taken from the dust of the ground of the earth, and then the herbs and the trees and the roots and the vegetables and the fruits, if all of these grow out of the earth, then man was extracted from the earth, and the plants, etc., grow from the earth. It seems to me it would be almost common sense that the same nutrients that causes the herbs to grow and the trees and the barks to grow were the same nutrients that were built into the body of man. So the best way for man to replenish himself is to replenish himself off of the nutrients from the earth. And so it would make sense, just common sense. It's not even scientific. It's almost common sense. You know, sometimes common sense can trump science. And so you've been listening to Phase 3 Wellness. We're down to about 3 minutes. And we did have one other issue to talk about, and it was the dandelion. And if I can finish it here in maybe a minute and a half, and talk about dandelion. Dandelion is one of my favorite herbs. And I'm going to have to speak you through here. But dandelion is one of those herbs that it's very beneficial when it comes to cleaning your liver, and also is very beneficial for your kidneys. And for instance, dandelion is a very rich source of beta carotene, which your liver converts to vitamin A. It's also rich in vitamin C, fiber, potassium, iron, calcium, magnesium, zinc, and phosphorus. It's also a good place that you can get B complex vitamins from, your trace minerals, organic sodium, and even vitamin D. So dandelion also contains protein. It even has more protein than spinach. And it's been eaten for a very long time, especially if you pick it at the right time, especially if you can choose it at the right time. If you don't get it the right time, it can be a bit bitter. But it's been used to treat anemia, scurvy, skin problems, blood disorders, and depression. And I think I've talked about this before when we were going through some of our herbs. But it's a good digestive aid. It's good for your kidney, as I said before, to help clear out waste, salt, and excess water. It's a great digestive aid. It's actually a mild laxative. It's good for diabetes. Recent animal studies actually have shown promise that dandelion actually helps regulate your blood and your sugar insulin levels. It's beneficial for high blood pressure, cholesterol, gallbladder health, inflammation, as well as your immune system. Dandelion is not an herb that you want to be without. I would recommend that you would consult or do your research on it, consult with a knowledgeable natural health care practitioner or a medical doctor who is learned in natural remedies. Again, you've been listening to Phase 3 Wellness. I am your host, Dr. Keith Henry. I'd like to remind you that this, if you join us late, this replay will be available probably in about 5 or 10 minutes after the show is done for. Again, join me again next week, the same time. I want to thank you for listening. And until next week, be blessed.